Greetings, and welcome to the IOMSN Town Hall Discussion, New and Emerging Therapies Challenges for MS Nursing. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. A brief question-and-answer session will follow the formal presentation. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star zero on your telephone keypad. As a reminder, this conference is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to introduce your host, Lori Maier. Thank you. You may now begin.
Thank you. Good evening, everyone. My name is Lori Maier. I am Director of Medical Research Services for the MS Clinic of Central Texas, which is in Round Rock, Texas. And on the behalf of the IOMSN and my co-chair of this program, Jen Schmirka, we would like to welcome all of you to the first town hall discussion. Tonight's discussion is entitled New and Emerging Therapies, Challenges for MS Nursing. The sessions will be held by telephone on the third Tuesday of each month, and each discussion will be led by an IOMSN member, and she or he will speak on a specific topic for approximately about 15 minutes, and then we will follow it with open discussion, which is limited to about an hour. We would like to acknowledge and show our appreciation to Biogen IDEC for supporting this project through an unrestricted education grant. Thank you, Biogen IDEC. So, we begin 2011 town hall discussions this evening with Carolyn Griffin. Carolyn is an RN, BSN, and certified clinical research professional currently working as the research manager of the MS Clinic. Oops, I lost it. At the University of Mass Memorial Medical Center in Worcester, Massachusetts. She has been involved in investigational MS research for about 2 years, and she is planning on taking her MSCN certification this summer, I believe in Boston, at one of our satellite locations. We really appreciate her volunteering to share her hands-on experience with us tonight, so please join me in welcoming Carolyn for this evening's meeting. Carolyn?
Thank you, Laurie. I'd like to start by saying until the early 1990s, effective treatment was limited to the administration of corticosteroids during acute attacks. Even before that, adrenocorticotropic hormone was a staple, IV-ACTH. I distinctly remember as a new nurse, grad nurse, hanging that medication for our MS patients on my med-surg floor. Then years of research in the previous decade with drugs to treat the actual disease and not just the symptoms came to fruition when beta interferon 1B and 1A was introduced in 1993 and 1996 and glatiramer acetate in 1996. The course of MS could now be altered by reducing disease activity and preventing attacks. In 1999, midazolam was approved for treating MS. And natalizumab, the first of a whole new class of drugs called monoclonal antibodies, significantly suppressed relapses of MS in several large trials. And although that's not a first-line drug, it's in studies right now to put that up against being a first-line drug, so that's something coming down the pike as well. More progress in the treatment of MS has been made in the past 10 to 15 years than in the previous 100 years. A new generation of MS therapies is emerging with novel mechanisms of action and new delivery modalities such as infrequent infusions and oral administration. And tonight we'll talk about some of those emerging treatments and especially what the implications of these new therapies will have on your nursing practice. In September of 2010, a historic event occurred with the FDA approval of the first oral drug to treat MS, fingolimod. And fingolimod is a synthetic analog. It's actually made from a fungus called Ascaris sinclairi. And this compound is the first in a new class of immunomodulatory drugs called S1P1 receptors. And S1P is short for sphingosine 1-phosphate. The effect of the lymphocyte trafficking is presumably the main mechanism of how it works. It binds to 4 out of the 5 receptors. The binding to the S1P1 is particularly important to its proposed mechanism of action, as this one is highly expressed on the T and B lymphocytes and is responsible for regulating the aggressive lymphocytes from lymphoid tissue. The doctor I work with likes to use the analogy of a roach motel, not very glamorous, but the fact that it kind of traps the lymphocytes in outside the lymph tissue, and this way prevents them from circulating. And by preventing them from circulating, they can't mount that autoimmune reaction to the myelin sheaths surrounding the axons that are so the hallmark of MS damage. There's been trials, obviously, to get to this point, and just in the interest of time, I'll summarize by saying that Transforms looked at the comparison of the two doses and the interferon beta-1A, and Freedoms looked at the two doses of drug compared to placebo. Both of them, both trials showed a decrease in annual relapse rate as well as MRI activity. Over the course of the trial, it was determined that there was no statistical difference between the 1.25 milligram dose and the 0.5 milligram dose, and actually a little bit higher side effects with the higher dose. So the decision was made to go ahead and just market it with the 0.5 milligram dose. Through the course of the clinical trials, we realized obviously some of the possible side effects, which is now transforming into what you'll be seeing out in the general public. The FDA actually put together what's called a risk mitigation and strategy plan. It's summarized very nicely on the website there, but basically I'm going to quickly go over what the side effects are and just tie them in a little bit with the what was seen in the trial. So the first thing are things to consider before starting treatment. That would be to monitor their white count, CBC, but especially their white count, leukocyte, neutrophils. It actually shown that there's a 30 to 40% reduction in circulating counts after starting the fingolimod. The other thing to monitor right prior to treatment is the liver function test. Finally, we'll also have a baseline ophthalmology exam. They've been shown that patients can develop macular edema. The interesting thing about macular edema is that it can present as the same visions in an MS attack, optic neuritis. They might not even notice they have the symptoms of macular edema, just notice that they have difficulty with vision. So you want the patients will have a baseline, and then they'll have a visit 3 to 4 months later. Prior, you also want to talk to your patients about having a varicella vaccine. If they haven't had chickenpox, then they'll want to have the vaccine and then wait 1 month after treatment. Let me just jump back to the macular edema. About 4% of patients who receive fingolimod develop the macular edema, 0.4%, excuse me, so that's where that comes in. And there was deaths related to the herpes and varicella zoster. Although they are a small number, too, it's still an important consideration to bring it up with patients, as well as the fact that after beginning Gilenya, excuse me, fingolimod, they should not have a live vaccine. The other issue is patients who have cardiac disease. One of the interesting things about the fingolimod is that the expression of it is in the heart as well. So in other words, being an S1P1 receptor, it also expresses in the heart muscle, so patients can have bradycardia with the first dose. Again, this is seen with the first dose, mainly. So what you will want to do is for the first 6 hours, the patient will have to remain in your clinic and be monitored with possible blood pressure and EKG if they're at high risk. Interestingly enough, this occurs within the first dose, the first 6 hours. You'll want to monitor them for that. Patients at high risk with respiratory illness will also want to, doctors will want to consider having pulmonary function test as well. Again, a small number of patients did have a decrease in their spirometry test as well as their using carbon dioxide. So if a patient develops difficulty with shortness of breath, cough, et cetera, that is something that you want to consider maybe the fingolimod is causing. Finally, the patient at home, what would you talk to them about? Once they're home, you want to instruct them on the side effects in terms of infection risk. Again, the lymphocyte count is reduced about 20 to 30% from the baseline, so they could be at risk for developing infection, and this could persist for even 2 months after stopping the drug. Other things to talk to about them when they're at home is that should they stop the drug for 2 weeks they would have to have the whole first dose monitoring again. In other words, say they were ill, they stopped, they had the flu, they couldn't eat, they stopped for 2 weeks. If they want to restart the pill, they need to go back into the clinic. Again, that's related to the lowering of the heart rate that was seen in the clinical trials. The patient would want to report any signs of infection again, and childbearing is very important. As you know, with most drugs, they do not test them on pregnant women or fetuses. However, just by the basic mechanism of the drug, is concern of fetal risk. So there would have to be adequate birth control by a childbearing woman as well as possibly her partner. And then the patient, after 2 months of discontinuation of the drug, she should still follow the birth control precautions because, once again, the risks remain at that point. So we'll probably find out talking a little bit more about Angolamod as we have our discussion, as it will be a challenge for many sites, I'm sure, to incorporate that tactile monitoring into their everyday practice. The other drug that comes into play, an oral drug, it's not approved yet, but is cladripine as well. And cladripine is a study that was done, and there's over 1,300 patients in 32 countries, and they show an annual relapse rate of anywhere from 50% with a 30 to 40% less disability and a decrease in their MRI lesions as well. The cladripine works by inhibiting DNA synthesis. It offers a very short course of therapy. However, some of the considerations is that there's a long period of suppression of the white count, and that's a concern is with cancer, shingles, infection. They're hoping in February to see this oral drug possibly approved by the FDA, and more will come about that at that time. Australia and Russia have actually already approved it. So, again, that's another oral drug that has, prolonged immunosuppressive effects, but appealing with its short course of dosing. There's also a few more oral drugs that are coming down the pike. And one of them is oral fumarate. It's a drug with phase 2 and phase 3 studies, also showing significant reduction in MRI lesion. It's well-tolerated, and its most common side effects are skin flushing and GI symptoms. Leuquinamod, again, another oral drug, shows trends in reducing the number of GAD-enhancing lesions compared to placebo, and it's supported by a number of MRI studies. It's generally well-tolerated, but with rare cases of reversible mild arthralgia, arthritis, edema, and studies, again, are still ongoing. And teriflunomide is another drug, again, another oral drug. Right now it's being used to treat rheumatoid arthritis, and it's showing a benefit in the MS studies that reducing GAD-enhancing lesions, again, supported by MRI studies. And it was, again, generally well-tolerated with some mild adverse effects such as nausea, nasopharyngitis, alopecia, and elevated liver function tests. The other class of drug that is very, very promising is alemtuzumab. That's a immune cell-depleting antibody, a monoclonal antibody. Its effect is currently regarded as the main mechanism of action in MS patients. Is directed against the CD52 cells, which is directly expressed on the surface of certain lymphocytes, and it causes a reduction in the T cells as well as B cells and monocytes. Right now, the CARE-MS studies are going on. It's fast-tracked to the FDA. Just a quick overview of the CARE-MS studies. At the AAN in Toronto, some information was released saying that 4 years after receiving their first treatment, more than 70% of MS patients on alemtuzumab remained free of relapse and showed no clinical disease activity. The difference is highly statistically significant, reports Dr. Cole. More of the patients treated with alemtuzumab as compared to beta interferon 1A maintained a clinically disease-free status through 4 years, and approximately 90% of alemtuzumab-treated patients have no sustained disability progression through that time. However, high gain, and there's concern about certain side effects. In the clinical trials right now, patients are monitored monthly. Some of the greatest concerns include thyroid disorders, most notably hyperthyroidism, and particularly Graves' disease. Also, ITP, idiopathic cytopenia, which is when you're risk of bleeding, and we monitor the patients with their platelet count, as well as we do a phone call with them or have them do an online questionnaire every month to talk about if they have unusual bruising or bleeding in their stool or urine, et cetera. Infection is a risk as well of any of these immunosuppressive treatments. And another thing we monitor for is the foot pasture disease or anti-GBM disease. And although it's rare, you'd want to ask your patients about having blood in their urine or blood in their sputum, as it can manifest in the, either the kidneys or the lungs. One of the appealing things about the alemtuzumab is that it's given IV. Right now in the clinical trials, it's given 1 year apart. The first time is 5 consecutive days. The second time would be 3 consecutive days, and then treatment on an as-needed basis after that, but no more than, closer than 12 months. So as you can see, that's very appealing. Infusion reactions, can occur, and it's treated with Benadryl, Tylenol, Solumedrol, some of your usual mitigating treatments. And there is a lot known about alemtuzumab in the sense that it's been used to treat and still is a leukemia, CLL.
Carolyn, yes. I think our time, we need to move along a little
bit. Okay, all right.
So thank you for all that information. We will now be opening up the lines for questions. So Shay, please go ahead and open the queue for our discussion.
Thank you. We'll now be conducting a question and answer session. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in question queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your question from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star keys. One moment, please, while we poll for questions. Our first question comes from Jennifer Smadick.
Hi there. This is Jennifer Smirka, actually, but I just wanted to thank everybody for joining, also as a co-chair, but also, Carolyn, thank you very much for a very quick assessment of everything that's gone on, really, since 1993 in 15 minutes. It's pretty impressive. My question to you and really to the rest of the listening audience is I'd like to kind of open it up, the discussion, and ask specifically to fingolimod, since that is the most recent new drug therapy, is how are people monitoring in their clinical sites if they are doing it on site, or are they utilizing outside resources, and what's been the experience? And Carolyn, I really want to kind of direct that question to you initially, is in your clinical site, how are they working with the REMS program, and how has it been going so far?
Interestingly enough, we actually had a conversation today with the MS fellows. They're putting together the application for the formulary to the hospital. The patients have their prescriptions and their medications, but they can't bring them into the hospital to be dosed yet because it's been accepted by the formulary. However, with that being said, the doctors, their proposal is that the patient have a baseline complete blood count and hepatic panel, a baseline EKG, baseline PFTs, and baseline eye exam, and then six-hour observation, which includes EKG before and after dosing and for any symptoms, telemetry monitoring for the whole 6 hours, the vital signs before and after, and, of course, having atropine available. So they're taking somewhat of a conservative approach in that they're not just looking at the patient's background in terms of what drugs they're on for their cardiac status. They're pretty much using EKG and telemetry monitoring for every patient who's going to go on the fingolimod.
That's interesting, because it's almost as though they're following the protocol for the Freedom 2.
Exactly. Yes, I would say that's true.
Are they doing that to try to capture, like, post-marketing data, or is it just really because of their comfort level at this point?
I think it's their comfort level at this point, to be honest with you. As people who do clinical trials know, the inclusion-exclusion criteria is fairly strict. So now that, you know, the exclusion criteria removed anybody who was on any of those class 1 or 3 drugs, as well as patients who had a resting heart rate less than 55, so now, where we're opening this up more to the general public, they're just being more cautious to make sure that they offer the safest care.
Are they following the same, you know, it sounds like they're following the same safety protocol, but are they opening it up a little bit more, the inclusion-exclusion criteria?
Yes. So while they won't exclude those patients, they're adopting more of the actual protocol that was seen in the clinical trials.
I understand. Lori, what are you guys? Oh, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. Carolyn, I was going to ask you about the logistics. How have you worked, because we have, you know, we all work at different sites, and with starting to use fingolimod, the six-hour observation period, how are you working that out with your site?
Right now, our clinic is bursting at the seams. So what we do, what we'll have our patients do is go to the infusion room, and that way they'll have the continuous telemetry monitoring, et cetera. The good thing about that is the infusion room is where the first dose monitoring took place for the protocol, and even though there was a dedicated research coordinator who stayed with the patient during that first dose monitoring, the infusion room nurses were very aware of what was going on because they would be involved should they need to. So that's how it's being handled right now with the infusion room, and it will get billed out to that as well for the time and the nursing care that's being done there.
Okay, thank you very much. Jen, thank you for your input. Let's go ahead and move on to the next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Cheryl Collins from San Antonio, Texas.
Hello, and thank you again for posting this. My question is for the oral Gilenna. When you have the varicella zoster, you know, are you doing a self-report history, or are you testing everybody? If they say that they have had chickenpox, is that good enough? And also, question two, when they're on the medication, can they ever take then a live virus?
In my setting, as far as the self-report, they're taking a self-report. However, if there's any question, then they would go ahead and do the varicella testing. As far as the live virus goes, they can get the live virus only after they've been off the fingolimod for 2 months.
Okay, so if they continue on it, then they can't.
Correct. And interestingly, just to note, when I was at the meeting in Fort Lauderdale this past week Novartis talking about another ongoing study, the woman that they had, there was, I think, two people who died, but the one person that had varicella, she had not had the chickenpox. She was a school teacher and was exposed to the chickenpox at her place of work.
That is interesting. And I actually was also at that same investigators meeting for EPOC, so I'm going to be a sub-PI. And I do have a question because, I mean, I know that I was very interested to hear that, you know, unless it's a very high risk, you don't have to even check an EKG. In fact, you don't even have to check blood pressure and heart rate. It's just purely six hours of monitoring. Now, that's not what we're doing. We're checking their blood pressure and heart rate, but we're doing it in just the physical therapy area. So I think there's kind of a wide variance there.
Well, that's a good point, and I think they kind of touched upon that you're right. There's going to be a you know, these are the recommendations by the FDA, but how each site will carry them out will be different. As you recall at the meeting, they even talked about the eye exam can be done by the neurologist. And I know that that's not what we're adopting. We're definitely sending our patients out, but their concern was sites that maybe, you know, are a little bit more out, you know, in the country, et cetera, that doesn't have the access to the eye care that maybe a city would. So you're right. It will be very varied. And so it will be interesting to see what happens with some of the studies, the safety studies that come out, you know, in another year or two after it's been out there in the general public.
Well, and I think that, Carolyn, you brought up a very good topic about long-term safety,
mm-hmm.
which is going to be something that we're going to have to keep our eyes on as far as down the road with the emerging therapies. But as far as the varicella titer at our site, if the patient says that they know that they had the chickenpox, mm-hmm. then we don't go and test it.
Mm-hmm.
If they haven't, we will. If it's negative, then we'll have them go and get it.
Mm-hmm.
And then there actually is a booster the initial day and then 128 days after. And
mm-hmm.
then you can check the titer maybe the following week after that. And
mm-hmm.
we found that, you know, the titer is positive after that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you can consider using fingolimod.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you also brought up a very good point about using your physical therapy. I think the logistics for a lot of sites can be very difficult because our resources, you know, we may not have enough space, enough personnel to be able to observe the patients for that long period of time. And actually our site is outsourcing. It's Concerta, I think, is the facility that is actually observing them for the 6 hours dosing and observing them for us. And they're in constant contact with us, and we're managing the patient, but they are watching them for the observational period. So that has made it very, very easy for our site to actually prescribe the medication, fingolimod. Okay, I think maybe we can go on to the next question.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Tony Saldana King from Houston, Texas.
Hi, Carolyn. Just want to say thank you. That was a great job. I had a question. We have recently given one of our patients, Jelenia, but she failed to mention that she had had some body aches, and, you know, she didn't mention that she had felt kind of like flu-like or might have had a fever. And I was just wondering, I mean, moving forward, how have you guys experienced that?
You mean she had a fever after the fact,
no.
or like right when you were administering it to her? And then she told
no.
you, oh, by the way, that day I felt.
Right. She's like, she called the office. We were closed on Monday, but she left us, called the on-call doctor and mentioned that over the weekend, she felt feverish and had a fever of 101, and
oh.
she meant to let us know that she felt kind of achy. When we do our first dose monitoring on Fridays. We try to clear our patients and see our patients that day. So, yeah, she kind of neglected to mention that. And so I think moving forward, we're probably going to mention that all of our patients, if, you know, despite the fact that they've been off drug, you know, for X amount of time, to please let us know if they have any kind of flu symptoms.
Right.
But I didn't know if you guys experienced that, because you know how some of them can be a little tricky.
Mom, how can I hear you?
Sorry.
I understand.
Yeah.
You know, that's a good question. I guess the only thing that you can do is just kind of reiterate that. I know sometimes I think in all the years
Sorry
of being
nurse,
it's still kind of surprising when people come in and say, oh, yeah, by the way.
I know. I mean, well, that's like some of our Tysabri patients, they'll kind of hold out and say, oh, by the way, we had a, you know, a urinary tract or a UTI. So.
Right. Sometimes they're afraid to miss their dose, et cetera, so they don't want you to know.
Exactly.
I know. So I think, you know, just what you do ask, and then, you know, your documentation.
Right.
Is also important, too, to show that you're aware. I'm not really, yeah. Is she okay, at least now?
Well, we just kind of had her follow up with her primary care just to make sure she didn't have, you know, strep or any flu.
Right.
Or
and followed up
like
her
that.
Signs, possible signs of infection. Absolutely. I mean, that would be the other thing, of course. But, yeah, I mean, in terms of preventing, I don't know if any of the other ladies here have any other thoughts.
Right.
Okay, thank you, Tony. We will go on to the next question, but I did want to say I did mispronounce the service that watches our patients for it. It's called Concentra, I believe, instead of Concerta. So, Shay, if you'd like to go ahead and get to the next person.
Yes, our next question is coming from Marie Namey from Cleveland, Ohio.
Well, good evening, everyone. As president of IOMSN, I'm thrilled that these conferences have started, and I'd like to thank you so much for getting this together. It was a great presentation, really comprehensive. I appreciated that. So my question, as well as complimenting everyone, because this really gives us a great opportunity to share with one another our practice. I work in a large institution, and a big concern, in addition to the what I call rigmarole to get people started on cyclamide, was how will we bill for this? And I was wanted to ask about in other practices what's going on. We have decided to have a shared medical visit, which is run by EPN, and we have groups of patients come in 10 at a time and do an education session.
Mm.
And then will we dispense? We do identification of the patients. We check vital signs. We'll have an MA who does that, dispense the med, and then there's an education session by the APN and individual then time with each patient, maybe a 15-minute kind of visit, some documentation, and then patients are monitored in a large conference room.
Oh, that's a great
and periodically
idea.
Periodically, their vital signs are checked. So I was just wondering, you know, what are the other ways that groups are managing this?
I think that's a very good question, so we'll leave that open for discussion because I know we all have different types of MS practices as far as our resources that we have available. Shay, would you like to check with the next caller and see if they could provide, you know, their input on what they're doing at their site?
Our next question is coming from Amy Perrin-Ross from Chicago, Illinois.
Hi, Amy.
Ms. Perrin-Ross, your line is live. Okay, we'll go then to the next question. Our next question is coming from Lynn Boyer from Scottsdale, Arizona.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. I suspect Amy may have had hers on mute, too, and not known it. I have a couple of questions. Our clinic does not really have facilities for treating in any cardiac issues, so I'm a little bit concerned about our first patient who's coming up on his FDO here in the next week or so. One thing that I wanted to point out is Concentra cannot accept any patients who are on a government payer. So no Medicare, no Medicaid, no TRICARE, none of those. So we don't have the option of sending those patients to Concentra. And my second question would be, what is Concentra's FDO procedure? What is their planned procedure? Does anyone know that answer?
Their planned procedure for what exactly?
For first day observation for Gilenya. Because they've actually contracted with Novartis to provide this, is my understanding.
From what I understand, the observation, there is a doctor on staff. There are private rooms, areas for the patient for to be observed for the whole 6 hours. Chris vitals are done on an hourly basis. The eye exam and the ECG is done pre-dose, and it is available there from what I understand if it's needed. The physician who is on staff is in close contact and can be, of course, at any point with the physician who is prescribing the medication. We've had a few patients who have gone through that way, and you brought up a very excellent point about what type of patients they do accept. But as far as anything in addition, I'm not sure exactly what's all involved with it, to be honest with you.
Okay, because our billing specialist told us that there wasn't really anything billable.
I agree, and I think this was our biggest problem, is that with the resources that we have, that we would not be able to bill. But now Marie had talked about a little bit earlier about how they were actually setting up certain appointments, and I think billing through that way. Is there anybody who can give us a little more information on the billing process?
I know at our site, I don't know what the actual, of course, dollar amount is, but they're billing just for nursing care time, those 6 hours.
What about the reimbursement then? I mean, they can bill, but the reimbursement.
Right.
The time involved.
Right. And from what I understand, I mean, it's, if you look at the numbers for what they're even billing, just assume that you're even getting 100%, it's not huge for about 6 hours when they're taking up a chair. It's not ideal. I can't deny that. It's not ideal.
Well, and I think for maybe small offices or small private offices, it can be much more difficult to actually absorb those costs.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, we can move on to the next question, or if somebody else would like to add their opinion on this topic.
Our next question is coming from Jennifer Smirka.
Hi there, can you hear me?
Yes, Jen. Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, thanks, Lori. So, I just wanted to add, I was doing it in the, I've only done 3 patients, so my sample size is quite small, but I was actually doing similar to the way Marie was doing it as well, is where we would have the 3 patients at the same time, and I was actually doing EKG prior to each dose, just the before, and doing vital signs hourly. The research team is actually doing that. But I would sit with the patients for about 45 minutes and go through an education, go through the patient medication guide and the package insert with them, and just review any questions that they had, review expectations, and then I actually charged each of them for a level 5 based on time, face-to-face counseling, and then I took them each separately into a room and did a very brief physical exam, again, just to kind of help try to substantiate my billing. Unfortunately, though, the only reimbursement that we have received thus far was actually on one patient only, and it was for my face-to-face visit and my encounter, the medical visit. It wasn't actually for the observation, and we haven't been reimbursed for the EKG. Now, granted, this is I'm in South Florida, and so I think it not only is based on payer mix, but also the contract that you have with each insurance company, and also I think to where you are. At least that's been my experience. So I would be curious if, Marie, if you're still on the line, I would love to hear what type of reimbursement you guys have had, if you know the information. And I do understand it's a little tough. I think we have to, even if you want to comment on a question, I think you have to go through the question line. Unfortunately, we don't have an ability on this teleconference to open it up so that people can just jump in. You actually have to go through the *1 queue. So with that, I'm going to step out and allow somebody else to jump in with a comment.
Okay. Thank you, Jen.
Thanks.
Thank you. Our next question comes from Brenda Mass from San Antonio, Texas.
Hi, Lori.
Hi, Brenda.
Hi, Carolyn. This is Brenda from San Antonio when we shared some
yes.
time.
Yes.
How
Hello.
Are you?
Oh, good.
Well, listen, my question is, if anyone listening, if anyone's had any patients on Gilenya, would that initial dose become symptomatic with bradycardia?
That's a good question. Very good question. Carolyn, have you had any?
You know what? I had, when we did the study, we did not have anybody become symptomatic with the bradycardia. We had somebody whose pulse went down a little bit, and they actually got up and walked around a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and their pulse came up. But nobody became, symptomatic and needed any intervention. Thank goodness.
Okay.
Great. And also, I just wanted to interject something along the lines of the reimbursement for Gilenya. It's been too soon still to see what our payers are going to pay out on that yet for us to know, for our side anyway.
Mm-hmm.
It may be a little longer before we all really kind of get a better idea of that.
That's true. I mean, this is all a whole new process for us. And as any new event like this, it takes a while for us to figure the logistics of the situation out. So if anybody is in queue that has experienced having a patient with bradycardia, we would love to hear about your experience.
Our next question is a follow-up from Amy Perrin-Ross from Chicago, Illinois.
Can you hear me now?
Hi, Amy.
Can
yes.
you hear me? Oh,
uh-huh.
good. I was talking away to myself. I've been no. Nonetheless, I apologize. I'd like to thank both Jen and Lori for the wonderful job they're doing, and certainly to Carolyn for this nice comprehensive overview as well. It's been great. My initial question actually was about reimbursement, and I guess to comment on some of the discussion about reimbursement, one of our first patients, because we, like many of you, are just absolutely swamped and cramped, we, at least as of right now, are not doing the first dose observation in our clinical arena. We're shipping them off to a multitude of places, and our Novartis reps are scrambling around to try to find some of these places. Well, one of the first places was a small infusion center, and what they decided to do was the telemetry monitoring. And before we signed an order and agreed to the kinds of things that they were going to do, we had them look into it, and it was going to be several thousand dollars for the telemetry monitoring, and the insurance said thanks but no thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Without putting our patients at risk of getting a whopping bill from someplace, I think that's something that it's incumbent upon us as nurses to identify, what are the costs incurred. And I guess my question then would be to Carolyn, do you have any idea of how much you're billing for the telemetry and or is anybody paying it?
That's a good question. And, no, I don't. And this actually, all this proposal was to even get it on the formulary and at the hospital. And I wish I, at my clinic, I do the research and I don't cross over too much into the other clinical realms. So I'm not as knowledgeable about the billing, et cetera. But as somebody who spent 15 years in private practice, I'm curious about how they'll deal with it. It's always a big problem. I will ask about that too, because you're right. I mean, it's one thing to say, okay, well, they'll go there for 6 hours, have monitoring, blah blah blah, and then you have a huge bill. You submit it, and you don't get back. Meaning,
Amy, is there any chance with that they would do a prior authorization before that would?
Well, that's again, I think so much of this is so new that people aren't really aware. And the insurance companies in particular aren't even aware of what they're looking at or looking for.
Right.
I mean, I've still got insurance in Illinois looking for us to take our patients off disease-modifying therapy before they'll approve Ampira for us. So, you know, they're a little behind the eight ball. Maybe it's just that their brains are all frozen, so who knows. But nonetheless, you know, they don't know what questions to ask. So far, no prior authorization. But I was extremely suspicious when I saw all of this thing. I mean, one of the other things that the facility wanted to do was start an IV line and have IV access for the entire time. Well, in an infusion center, that makes sense, but...
Right.
If you look at both Freedoms and Transforms in terms of the percentages of people, number one, who had any bradycardia, and number two, that were symptomatic for it, I think we're running up or potentially running up all kinds of costs here that are probably really not necessary. And again, I think it's incumbent upon us as nurses involved in the care of these people to investigate what we're signing them up for, because, you know, if their insurance gets billed for this big telemetry bill and then turns it down flat, does that leave it to the patient? And, wow, you know.
So those are all very good points that you brought up. I think we all, you're right. We all need to think about the whole process. Okay, well, thank you, Amy. I think we still have time. Can we move on to another question?
Our next question is coming from Maureen Amy from Cleveland, Ohio.
Hi, everyone, again.
Hi.
So in response, this is a little tough. You got a star in every time. For our group visits, we have not yet had any knowledge of what we're going to get reimbursed for the level four that's really been billed. My understanding is we can't bill on time for a group visit, but we bill on documentation. And because of the risk, because there's a risk associated with cenglamide, that sort of ups the ante. So 10 patients billed at level 4, it takes 3 hours of a nurse time. That's not too bad, I guess. But we'll see what happens in terms of getting reimbursement. I'll try to let everyone know at some way. The other point or the other question and comment I have is that you'd asked about bradycardia, and I kind of wanted to know what was the magic number for bradycardia. There's a question of is it 50 or 55 for a pulse rate in our place, and we had a person who had a lower than 50. I think it was a 48 pulse rate, and after just walking around, their pulse rate came up.
Mm-hmm.
So that was just sort of, that's is one of the interventions, I guess, that's best utilized when a person's heart rate goes down. But is there a magic number out there? That's my other question.
Carolyn, can you answer that?
You know, at the meeting this past week, they talked a little, kind of twofold. They talked about under 60, but then they also talked about, they looked at the symptoms, too. Like, say a patient was 80, and they dropped, 14 beats, but then also became dizzy and shortness of breath, then they would consider that bradycardia. So it was a little bit of twofold issue.
I guess this
I don't know if that makes sense, but...
Yeah, no, it certainly does.
Yeah.
You know, I think that the parameters are a little fuzzy still.
They are, and a little bit. I think even... Novartis, you know, having them try to answer some of the questions when we were at the meeting, et cetera, you know, they had a little bit of a hard time answering. Even that one, believe it or not. Because you're right, I had a patient today in another trial. He's 52, not his age, his pulse was 52. resting pulse was 52, but, you know, I wouldn't consider him bradycardia in the sense where, you know, obviously he needed any treatment. That's just, his usual baseline pulse.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Marie. Thanks for your input. Can we move on to the next question?
Our next question comes from Cheryl Collins from San Antonio, Texas.
Yes, hello again. As far as for bradycardia, I probably had a patient that was about also 48 and had him get up and move around. Mm-hmm. Plus, we told them to bring their lunches, so are having a little caffeine. We also had them in a conference room, and they were watching
videos. In fact, they were watching when Harry met Sally, and it was at the scene in the cafeteria, if anyone remembers that movie, so that certainly got their heart rate up. And we all may laugh, but it's true. So that seemed to work. As far as for reimbursement, our first patient for 6 hours, I did the whole observation myself. As far as for risk stratification, I, you know, assessed them if they had any cardiac risk factors. I had them get an EKG ahead of time. Otherwise, I just monitored their blood pressure and pulse. And first reimbursement was about $2,400. I think we got about $1,200, and the patient's responsibility was about $200. So,
okay, good information.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. Carolyn, I know you talking about reimbursements is something that maybe we can discuss again at another visit down the line, but let's go on to, we only have a few minutes left here. Let's go on to the next caller.
Our next question comes from Tony Saldana King from Houston, Texas.
Hey, guys.
Hi, Tony.
Hi. You guys had kind of mentioned something about the bradycardia. We actually had 8 patients this past Friday, and it was kind of hectic. And we did have one lady become very symptomatic, and the cardiologists or vascular surgeons, all those heart folks that I worked for, usually just, I guess, because Novartis probably can't tell you, but like, most cardiologists will say if the patient becomes symptomatic with their heart rate, then certainly, yes, you need to kind of have some intervention. But I think I kind of did like everybody else. We had chips, we had peanuts, salty peanuts, and we try to tell them, you know, certainly avoid caffeine products and, you know, the Cokes, the teas, the coffee, but we had that available for us too. And you guys were talking about the reimbursement. I Novartis, you know, had they heard anybody, and I guess someone else mentioned that it's really by state. Some people are getting, I think if we do a face-to-face observation, I mean a face-to-face and an observation, that we are getting some reimbursement, that or that they are seeing some reimbursement. We still have not yet received a whole lot of input back, but I'm not sure that our doctors were coding the observation or the face-to-face. I think they're like an upper level, especially if we went in and did training with the patient, kind of like Jennifer did. So that's really kind of that. And I just have one quick comment. It's not related to Gerlinia, but it was about the Triad alcohol pads. Did anybody, have you guys heard about that also?
Yeah.
I didn't. Okay. I just wanted to just kind of put that out there in case nobody else heard about that.
Yes, we did. We got the, thank you, Bill, for bringing that up.
Sure. Sorry about that, but thank you. That was it.
Thank you, Tony. I think we have time for maybe one more question.
We have no further questions.
Oh, we have no further questions. Okay. Then I guess this is a good time for us to close, and I'd like to thank Carolyn for her great discussion and her presentation. And I'd like to thank again Biogen IDEC for supporting these programs through the Unrestricted Educational Grant. Our next program will be with Dr. Eliza Ben-Zachariah, and she will be presenting When the Patient is Experiencing Breakthrough Disease. And that will be next month on the third Tuesday at the same time that we're doing right now. So Jennifer Smirka and I thank you, and the IOMSN thanks you all for joining, and we look forward to our next town hall discussion next month. I hope you all have a good evening. Good night.
Good night. Thank you.
Thank you. This does conclude today's teleconference. You may disconnect your lines at this time. Thank you for your participation.